99%ers, this is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions, where we continue to look at the trends in the U.S. and global economy. Okay, we're going to talk about a number of things today, but first we want to talk about the jobs numbers and the wage numbers in the U.S. economy. And then after that, we'll look a little bit at what's happening this past week in the global economy of interest, among which is it looks like now the economic and political elites in Europe are fighting with each other here. The European Central Bank, Mario Draghi, in a little tit-for-tat with the Germans and the Bundesbank and Wolfgang Schäuble and so forth. So this has been going on since the formation of the EU, and you see it even more significant developing here today. They're at each other's throats, increasingly blaming each other because these policies, QE, negative interest rates, etc., are just not working. And by the way, they're not working on the other side of the world either, with Japan and Abenomics, as it's called, Prime Minister Abe, and Big NERP, negative interest rates going on there. And now we got increasing concerns that it isn't producing results, not producing results for the currency or the stocks or anything else. So we'll look a little bit at Japan and why the Bank of Japan held off from apparently going further with NERP and QE and when they were expected to do so. And then we want to take a little look at China and the shadow banks, which have been a growing problem over there. Just can't, Chinese officials just can't get their hands around the China shadow banking sector now for 3 years, which did not exist prior to 2010, by the way. It's just a product of opening up China to Western finance capital and all the vultures getting in there directly or indirectly, and then the shadow banking system in China developing on its own and causing bubbles in property prices and bubbles in stock markets and bubbles and bubbles on bubbles. Anyway, we'll look a little bit at that. And then Puerto Rico. Yeah, Puerto Rico, it looks like it's defaulting here. And what does that mean? And what's the similarity between Puerto Rico and Greece? Well, it's a new kind of financial imperialism that is emerging here. I'll be talking about this in my book out in a couple of months called Looting Greece, the Emerging New Financial Imperialism. Yeah, there's a new form of a colonialism, a financial colonialism growing here in the world, beginning to emerge. We can see it clearly in Greece. And now we see the America's Greece, which is Puerto Rico. And we'll see more of this as time goes by as well, as global capitalism morphs and changes. But let's get back to the U.S. economy and talk about the U.S. economy here in these recent numbers. Last week, you know, I talked quite a bit about first quarter GDP numbers, flat, when you look at it quarter to quarter, and you adjust out the phony redefinition of GDP made in the U.S., it's flat. There's nothing there, quarter to quarter. Oh, they say 0.5% growth, but that's annualized. You see, the U.S. takes this quarterly GDP and multiplies it roughly by four to get an annual growth number. And other countries don't do that. They just say, okay, quarter to quarter, we grew this much. But the U.S. makes the number look bigger by annualizing it. So this 0.5% growth in the first quarter that was reported with preliminary GDP numbers is really only about 1.2% growth. Oh, excuse me, 0.125% growth if you just, you know, simply divide it by four, deannualize it. That's rough estimate. But, you know, it's really like 0.1%, and that's just statistically noise. And it's less than noise if you take out the 0.3% phony redefinition of GDP that occurred back in 2013 and got adjusted forward and backwards, which raised all the U.S. GDP numbers since the recession. Even when raising these GDP numbers, you still get, since 2007, the last peak of the U.S. economy, you still get only 10.1% total growth over 8 years, which is really 1.25% growth when you look at it from peak to peak. Now, it's not growing to 2.5% when you factor in the downturn and you look at it on a longer-term trend, not just year-to-year. I mean, the U.S. economy is barely stumbling along, has been. And now it looks like it's slowing down again, what I call the relapse, a one-quarter collapse. We've seen that five times. And the U.S. has been able to keep it from becoming a longer-term recession five times because it has control of the global currency, the dollar. And the U.S. Federal Reserve is the dominant central bank. And defense spending can be manipulated quarter to quarter. You know, you just release early some of the projected budget on defense spending when it looks like the economy is slowing, and that sort of mitigates the second quarter continuation of the decline. So, you know, the war spending, the dollar, the central bank are all ways that the U.S. can quickly respond when it looks like its economy is slipping into recession and mitigate it for a while, temporarily. Right? But the Europeans and the Japanese can't do that because they don't have as big a defense spending, and their currency is not as important, and their central banks are not as effective, or have nowhere near the influence that the U.S. central bank, the Federal Reserve, has. In fact, you know, the European Central Bank is hardly a central bank in the true sense of it. ECB, European Central Bank, that's one of the problems over there. They don't really have a banking union. So all those three key variables that the U.S. can manipulate quickly and really export its slowdown to the rest of the world, other countries don't have. And that's why the U.S. is growing slightly faster than Japan and Europe, okay? And the U.S., of course, the economic influence of the U.S. and the rest of the world is particularly clear when you see what happens with U.S. The value of the dollar rising or falling as a result of the Fed, the central bank, even saying, let alone doing, raising interest rates or lowering interest rates. You know, for example, every time the dollar rises and interest rates threaten to rise, and the dollar rises, you know, what happens? Well, the emerging markets go into funk. Right? The capital starts flowing back out of emerging markets, back to the U.S. And capital flight means their currencies collapse, their stock market collapses. The inflow of foreign capital to keep their economies going dries up. All that happens in these emerging markets whenever the U.S. Raises the value of the dollar and raises interest rates, which go in tandem, you see. And then the emerging markets have this global oil glut and commodity price deflation problem overlaid on all this. And, you know, that has other forces and concern causes that derive from the slowing global economy. So they're very sensitive. They're very fragile. And when the U.S. raises and lowers rates, you know, their prospects in emerging markets rise and fall. Right? So when the U.S. raises rates, that's a problem for emerging markets. But it's good for Europe and Japan, because Europe and Japan then don't have to devalue their currency further to get some export sales by pumping even more QE into the economy. You see, so the U.S. has to choose. It's a contradiction. Rock and a hard place. Do the U.S. actions more negatively impact emerging markets, where U.S. multinational corporations have big operations? Well, if emerging markets are negatively impacted, so are the profits of U.S. corporations in those countries. Right? The currency drops, they lose money. Right? You got to subtract that from the profit rate. But Europe and Japan don't have to devalue their currency. See, we got global currency wars going on, and it's being carried out by the central banks. It's not like in the 1930s, where countries simply declared they were devaluing their currency. No, it's all devaluation indirectly by monetary injections by the central banks that devalue their currencies. And we got a global fight going on, currency wars, as the global economy slows down in terms of total production and trade. They're all fighting for a little bigger share of a shrinking global trade pie. And if your countries like Japan and Europe, you're very dependent on exports. U.S. not as much, or countries like Brazil or so forth. They're really dependent on exports, commodity exports. So if the global economy and commodities and so forth are slowing down, these different sectors of the global capitalist economy are trying desperately to get a little bigger share of the shrinking pie, and they do that by devaluing, by monetary policy, QE, and so forth. And that tit-for-tat has been going on, particularly between Europe and Japan, engaging in dueling QEs and dueling NERPs, negative interest rates, NERPs. Right, all designed really to boost their exports a little bit by devaluing their currencies. But it's not working. You see, it's all wearing out. It had a little effect 2-3 years ago, but the effects are declining, both from QE and NERP. But they have nothing else that they want to do. Now, they could stimulate their economies fiscally, but you see, the finance capital elite have controls of those political system, and they don't want to see fiscal stimulus. They want the money pumped in through their conduit, and they skim off the lion's share, and maybe they trickle a little bit down. That's what they want. And that's why you got austerity on the fiscal side, and you have this open spigot on monetary policy on the monetary side. That's what the finance elite running these countries and these economies want. You know, flood us with free money. Flood us. And we promise to share a little bit. Well, they're sharing less and less for the rest of the economy. Okay, so that's why ever since 2008, globally, the dependency has been on monetary policy, on central banks, on pumping trillions and trillions, tens of trillions of dollars into these economies, which have the result of stimulating capital markets, stocks, bonds, derivatives, foreign exchange, property markets, etc. That's where all the money is going. Or it's going offshore. It went for a little while, went to China and places like that, emerging markets that had a real boom going on, but that's been declining since 2013. That's over. Right? So all the money's been going in financial speculation or just sitting on bank and corporate balance sheets, trillions and trillions of dollars. And they do everything they can to prevent their governments from stimulating Main Street and the rest of the economy through fiscal spending. They don't want that. That doesn't immediately benefit them. You see, fiscal policy and tax cuts for households and consumers and spending aimed at people who will spend it all because their wages have not risen. They don't want that. That's not a sure way of increasing their profits. They want it directly. Put it right in my pot here, my financial pot, and I'll do with it what I want. That's monetary policy, you see. Fiscal policy is, people are going to have to get money and spend, and maybe they'll buy our stuff, and maybe they won't, There's a big question mark there. That's why they're all opposed to fiscal policy everywhere. The elites everywhere are opposed to it. We can't even get infrastructure spending, in Flint and places like that, all throughout the East Coast, in the U.S., the sewer systems and the water systems and, all these basic urban systems are crumbling. And we can't get anybody to spend to repair them. That's okay, let the kids drink lead. Doesn't matter. Can't get as great profits as I can get from spending. speculating in stocks and derivatives. That's, you know, give me the money and I'll spend it there. I'll make the money real quick. There, you know, indirectly, how much money am I going to make lending to construction firms to repair the water system? Not as much. See, that's the problem. We have a new financial structure. We have a new finance capital lead. I've been talking about this, writing about this globally, that is dominating and running the global economy and the super wealth they've accumulated and the laws that they've changed allow them to dominate the government structures, the executives, the legislatures, to keep their power going. That's the problem. They're a cancer. They're a cancer in the economy, and the cancer is spread to the political system. And then you get Supreme Courts, you know, with Citizens United reflecting and helping them spend even more money. And then you get billionaires running, you know, speculating billionaires. That's what Trump is. That's how he made his money, borrowing other people's money and investing in real estate. He's a speculator. He's one of these finance capital elite. You know? And, of course, Hillary, what? She's tied in with them, too. You know, she's made how much money going speaking fees at these banks and finance banks and shadow banks and so on? You know, how much you think she's not going to do their bidding? They got a lock on the political system. And that lock is keep the free money flowing to us so that we can make quick profits and raise our capital incomes even faster through financial speculation and financial investments and financial markets all over the world. You know, rather than loaning to mom-and-pop businesses to make things that would mean hiring real people, that would mean giving people wages and jobs to buy consumption, to buy things. You know, right now, consumption, how is it going in the U.S.? Is debt, except for the top 10% earners. It's all debt-driven, not wage-driven. We'll talk about these wage figures here shortly, right? Because there's a lot of hype going around on the wage side here. Okay, so let's jump into that. Let's jump into the job and wage data here. U.S. Jobs report for April came out today. Showed 160,000 jobs created versus about 210,000 in previous months, so we've dropped to 50,000-60,000 in 1 month. Well, you know, job creation lags the real economy. And maybe we're starting to begin to see the effects on jobs with this 160,000 figure of the first quarter GDP stalling. Maybe. You know, I don't like to make too big a deal out of one month's data, or even one quarter's data, because they flop around. The numbers flop around too much. But, you know, it could be this 160,000 is a reflection of the beginning of a lagged wage, job trend. We'll see in coming months. By the way, that 160,000 barely reflects providing jobs for new entrants into the labor force. You know, economists differ on this, but roughly the estimate is 120,000, 150,000 new people enter the labor force, you know. People become, you know, turn in 17, 18, 20, and so forth. They enter the labor force. So that's an average. So, you know, in other words, they just created jobs last month to absorb the new entrants, not to reduce the unemployed levels that are still out there, or the people who have given up and aren't even looking for work. You know, to bring them back and give them jobs. Okay, let's talk about this job figures. You know, I talked a little bit last week, and I mentioned something called new business formation. The numbers you see that they report for jobs are statistical estimations. They aren't the raw jobs data, the actual jobs created or not created. You know, they take the raw data and they make statistical adjustments to them, like seasonality and so forth. And even the raw data is not the actual data of how many jobs were created, because they reach back months prior to the current period, and they make assumptions about new business formations. They're looking at numbers for new business formations lagged 9 months. In other words, net new business, every month, you know, we have hundreds of thousands of businesses that are formed, mostly proprietorships, and hundreds of thousands of businesses that give it up, right, become defunct. Businesses disappearing and businesses forming. You know, we have like, what, 9 million businesses in this country. This number of net new business formations, they make certain assumptions of how many employees are employed with each new business formation. They don't know exactly how many each of these new businesses that are formed are employing, or how many the new businesses that are going out of business, you know, had employed. But they make assumptions about the numbers. They only have this data for 9 months ago, 6 to 9 months ago, and then they take that 6 to 9 months data and they roll it into the current raw data, right? And then they do their statistical operations on top of that. So, but if the economy was doing very well last summer, much better than it's doing now, you would have had more net new business formations, and therefore that number would be rolled into last month's raw data as well, and then they do some seasonality estimations and so forth, right? So the number of job creations is not really contemporary. It's a lot of assumptions and data of various kinds from different periods. It's not really showing you what happened last month, okay? Another problem is for unemployment rate purposes, part-time jobs are considered full-time for unemployment rate estimates. In other words, what I mean by that is the unemployment rate itself, you know, not the total number of unemployed and whether they're part-time and full-time. That's a different statistic. That's called the U6 unemployment rate, but For figuring the rate, you know, you're unemployed, right? If you're part-time, whatever, you lost a job, right? And there are assumptions here for what's called underemployed, the U6 underemployment rate, missing labor force. Those numbers are grossly underestimated, I believe, the underemployment meaning voluntary, involuntary, part-time, right? Independent contractors, people who have given up looking for a job after four weeks. They're not in the basic unemployment rate, the U3. And then you have the missing or marginal labor force, people who have given up looking. They're still unemployed, still would take a job if they could find one, unemployed for more than 12 months. Right. And all this, you know, we're talking about 7-8 million people here. Well, they show up in the U6 unemployment rate, but that number, I think, is still underestimating the true number of these people. See, they get this number by calling. The Labor Department actually makes phone calls. I think, 50, 60,000 a month or something like that, to homes. This then ask them, oh, are you working? No. If you're not working, and when's the last time you worked? When's the last time you looked for a job? Etc. Were you working full time, part time? Right, and that survey, phone call survey, does not pick up an increasing number of the workforce, the unemployed workforce. In other words, that's called the current population survey, right? And it focuses more on smaller businesses that the current establishment survey does not. You see, when you get a lot of reports in the press, they're usually talking about the current establishment survey, which focuses on larger businesses, about 400,000. You know, we got 157 million people in the labor force. So they sample, you know, it's not really a sample, 400,000 CES, larger business employment survey. That's the number that you often see reported. Well, that misses a lot of smaller businesses. That's where the current population survey of 60,000 phone calls kind of supplements. But the two surveys can be grossly different in terms of their numbers every month. Well, the problem with the CPS, it focuses on smaller businesses, but it misses a lot of undocumented workers, itinerant workers, and youth and small businesses. It misses them. Why? Because they call on phones. And undocumented people aren't going to take a call from the government, right? Itinerants are moving around, so they don't have established residence with established phone oftentimes. Well, and youth are working in the cities, urban youth and so forth, right? They're itinerant. They, you know, and then there's this question, cell phone numbers, right? Are they really picking up cell phone numbers? And more young people only have a cell phone. They don't have a landline. So there's some problems with these surveys, and I'm just going over some of them. You know, new business formation, net new business formation. Do they pick up all the underemployed and those who have left the labor force? Right? Is the survey really accurate and effective? These are all problems, you know, with the jobs data. Anyway, okay. Corporations are hiring. Have been hiring, you can't doubt that, right? But I wonder how, to what extent are the, you know, the massive layoffs that occurred in 2008-10 of full-time permanent employees are being hired back as part-time. You know, two part-time employees cost less than one full-time employee because you don't pay them benefits, the part-timers. Now, I would like to see some numbers in that regard. Right? When they call and they ask somebody, for example, and they're working the gig economy, Uber drivers, you know, they work at average 10 hours a week, and are they considered full-time or part-time? I don't know what's going on, how the Labor Department is really reflecting this new gig economy in terms of job numbers, whether it's accurate or not. Well, those are just problems, issues. Well, we'll see whether this trend continues. Right, in this declining trend in job creation continues in subsequent months. You know, construction jobs pretty much came to a halt here, maybe 1,000 last month in this report. Should be booming in April. This is the period, you know, when you have housing construction. Should be booming, but it isn't booming. Well, I don't know. Did they simply move up the construction job creation here a couple months because of, you know, early spring or something? I don't know what's going on there, but it's an anomaly that construction jobs that boom in April, May aren't doing so. What's happening here? And then we actually lost retail jobs. Over 3,000 retail jobs were cut. You know, in the previous month, construction retail jobs, they added 80,000. What the hell's going on? 80,000 in the construction retail jobs created in March, and then virtually none created in April. It smacks to me that there's something wrong with these statistics. You can't get that big a swing, you know, in these major areas of jobs. You know, naturally, normally, you know, you go from 80,000 to minus 2,000 in construction and retail. You know, yes, well, retail sales really did slow down in the first quarter. We talked about that. That has a lot to do with why first quarter U.S. GDP was flat. Yes. And then construction, well, you know, if they early hired a lot of people in construction, maybe that's why they didn't hire much in April. Could be. At the same time, the government keeps paring down the its employment, particularly postal workers. Tens of thousands being laid off, cut every month, right? And job creation remains focused to extend its occurring in healthcare services, professional services, and so forth. Okay, so it's a very, very mixed report here for jobs this past month. I want to talk about wages, you know, because we're getting a flurry in the press about, oh, wages are finally rising. And here the definitions and the data and the number and the sources are also misleading, very misleading. There are several ways to estimate wages. You could say, well, what's the share of total compensation, wages, salaries, benefits, in total national income? National income is all the income that's created in a given year based upon all the production and the services and so forth. You know, it's sort of like the flip side of GDP, national income. Okay, so how much of that national income has gone to people who work for a living, wages and salary, and how much has gone to people who live off of capital incomes, you know, interest and dividends and royalties and all that, you know, profits, et cetera, profit-derived forms of income, right? In the 1990s, the share of national income that went to total compensation, those wages and benefits, was 66%. Some identify total compensation with workers, you know, working class, that's their share. That's the wage share, they say. Well, it was 66% in the 90s and hit a low of 61% in 2013. And then now in 2015, it grew a little bit to 62.6%. You know, still down around 4%. Well, 4% of total national income, you know, you're talking about 4% of roughly $15 trillion or more. 4% of that. Well, that's a lot of money, 4% of $15 trillion. Well, that's the money that, you know, the share going to workers has declined. But there's a problem with this whole approach, right? If you're talking about a total number, like national income, and you're saying, okay, we're going to divide it into two parts, one part compensation for workers, the other part, you know, the difference percentage-wise goes to capital incomes. You know, if you're going to do that, then the numbers can change because the amount going to capital incomes has increased. Therefore, the percentage going to capital incomes rises, and the percentage to worker incomes must decline because you only, you know, two parts. If one goes up, the other has to go down. Right? Only two variables here. Well, if we had this huge increase in profits and capital incomes after 2008, which we did, right, the share of total income from profit derived from capital incomes would have gone up, and therefore the share of worker incomes would, by definition, go down. Now, the problem is, if the super profits and capital incomes don't rise as fast, then the total compensation wage incomes as a percentage will rise. But that doesn't mean that workers actually got more money, you see. It just means that the capital incomes got less. It still can be very significant, but they happen to get less. Therefore, the percentage share for labor rises. But it's not real, actual money in their wallets. It's just a way of making it appear. You know, if the super profits aren't growing as much, and therefore dividends and buybacks and so forth aren't growing as much, you know, then it looks like that share declines a little bit, and therefore, you know, minus one, the worker share grows, but it doesn't really grow. Plus, when you're talking about national income shares, you got to remember this interesting way they define it. Wages and national income are not simply what workers make, you know, wages, hourly wages or salaries and so forth. No, people, you know, who work for somebody else that you would think would be the definition. No, wages and national income include the profits of proprietors, small businesses. 65% of the profits, business income, they call it, of small businesses is considered wages. So small businesses' wages are rising, their income is rising, 65%, two-thirds of that roughly, is considered wages, and that's reflected in the wage compensation total in national income. So, you know, maybe it's small businesses making more and more money that is the cause of this compensation rising for the worker side, you know. That's just the way they defined it. Okay, so those are some of the problems when you look at, oh, total compensation is increasing in the U.S. for workers, right? Beware of that statistic. Another problem with compensation is that it includes benefit costs, not just wages. So in other words, the cost of your benefits for your health care and so forth, pensions, etc., may be rising, and that's, you know, you're paying more for that, or employers are paying more for that for their workers, and therefore it looks like compensation wages are actually rising for workers. Well, no, it's just the cost of health care is rising. Workers aren't seeing anything more in their paycheck, you know, but the benefit costs are increasing, and since compensation is wages from benefits, it looks like compensation is rising. There's another problem, and that's a way of looking at wages as hourly earnings. Hourly earnings are really hourly wages times the number of hours you work. So if your number of hours you work are rising, it appears your wages are rising if you define wages as earnings. Your average, the amount you're getting paid is not rising. You're just working longer hours, you see. So when you see average hourly earnings, it's not just wages. When you see labor compensation, it's not just wages. When you see total compensation, right, national income total compensation, it may be small business profits are rising. You got to dissect all these different ways of approaching wages. And also, you got to ask yourself, well, are they saying 2.5% wage gains, is that adjusted for inflation or not? You know, usually it's not even adjusted for inflation. For example, there was a study done not too long ago, I mean within recent weeks or months, that showed 18 to 34 workers, young workers, millennials, 18 to 34, when their wages are adjusted for inflation, this group is not making any more money today than the group their age back in 1984. In other words, more than 30 years later, this group is making, 18 to 34, it's making the same amount of take-home pay adjusted for inflation than their counterparts 30 years ago. They're not making any more. Amazing, isn't it? The economy has more than doubled. GDP has more than doubled since 84. Well, who got all that income from the doubling of the economy? Well, it wasn't the 18 to 34 group, was it? Somebody did. You know, that's GDP growth. That's national income behind it. Somebody got it, but the 1834s didn't. Right. If you look at wages, average hourly wages for production and non-supervisory workers, which is yet a fourth way, you know, first way, total compensation, national income, second way, labor compensation, third way, hourly earnings, fourth way, let's look at hourly wages for production and non-supervisory workers. In other words, CEOs and managers, you know, supervisors, you know, making salaries, we're taking that out of the picture, and we're just looking at average hourly wage, not times the hours worked, earnings, in other words, you know, not with benefits, compensation, but just hourly wage for workers who aren't managers, supervisors, etc. Hourly wage, not salary even. If you look at that, and they say, oh, it's grown 2.4%. But that 2.4% growth last year, right, and 2.4 roughly percent growth the first quarter of this year, same thing, same trend, right, is mostly skewed to the top 10% of wage earners. In other words, tech sector, software engineers, professionals, and so on and so forth. Right? It's 2.4%. In other words, if it goes to the top 10% is getting like 4 or 5% maybe, and the rest may not be getting anything. Right? May not be getting anything. That's a real problem. That's a real issue. The bottom 90% has been negative every year since 2007-08. The bottom 90%, right? Average hourly wage, production non-supervising employees, did not grow between 2008 and 2014 for the bottom 90%. The top 10% did, but not very much. Most of their compensation growth over this period was for the in benefits compensation, right? But if you look at the median, real hourly earnings, let's go back to earnings, wages and hours worked for the median workers in this country. 2010 did not grow at all. 2011 turned negative. It's been negative every year for the median worker. Those below, even more so, below the median. So wages and benefits and earnings has been, to the extent it's occurred at all for the working class, has been concentrated in the top 10%. The people at the median and below have been going backwards. And these figures about 2.4% for last year and this year, first quarter this year, you know, reflect this skewness to the very top, and you know it could be also minimum wage increases beginning to be implemented at the very bottom. But the middle, the big core of the American working class, the median, you know, has been going backwards for years in terms of earnings, adjusted for inflation. See, when I say negative every year, I mean it's adjusted for inflation every year, with the real spending power these wages and these earnings may be. Been going backwards, you know, clearly for 6 years now, since 2010, at the median and below. So when you see these, you know, figures, oh, you know, wages are growing 2.4% here, finally we got wage growth, you know, you got to look behind all the definitions here. It's tricky. It's tricky. And the definitions, you know, are you talking about total compensation in terms of national income shares? Are you talking about wages and benefits for labor, for workers? Does it include salaries? Is it adjusted for inflation, or is it real? Or is it, you know, like the EPI? Institute here, EPI, give some good numbers, some real numbers, right? Economic Policy Institute here. Go look at some of their analyses of this data, you know, which cuts through a lot of these definitions and makes clear what's really happening. See, the press, the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, they don't want to really reveal what's happening. But, you know, people kind of know what's happening after 6 years. They feel it in their paychecks. They feel it in their standard of living, right? And that's why they're so upset. We've been talking about that. And we'll continue now that it looks like Trump is the de facto candidate here for the Republicans. We'll see. You know, a lot can still happen. There's a lot of flux there. Some of the Republican establishment are accepting him and some aren't. You know, the big business types, you know, is this guy really going to be against free trade? I mean, that's anathema to them because that's, you know, big profits for the big multinationals. And he's talking. I still don't trust him. I still don't belief that these candidates really mean what they say anymore. But anyway, you know, some people were wondering, you know. Other conservatives want to attack Social Security and pensions and so forth, you know. And he says, no, we're not going to do that. We'll see. You know, Paul Ryan really wants to do that, right? That's at the core, you know, the Speaker of the House, Republican. That's really what he wants to do, you know. So that's why he is not so sure about Trump still. Trump not so sure maybe about him. You know, one of the events of the past week was Ryan said, I'm not sure I can support Trump yet, right? In other words, you're going to have to negotiate with me, Donald, and adjust some of your positions if you want me, mainstream big business conservative here, to endorse you. Well, Trump shot back, I'm not so sure I want to support you either. You see, Trump is clever. Trump is playing to the discontent with the two wings party system. He knows people are pissed off with both, and he's playing them. He's playing them on the right. He's appealing to the conservatives who don't like the Republican Party, don't think it's, you know, conservative radical enough. And he's playing even, he's crossing over, and he's playing to the working class on the Democrat side. That's very similar to what Reagan did in 1980. You see, people have short memories about these elections, but Donald Trump is in some ways an echo of Ronald Reagan in 1980. Yeah, Ronald Reagan was, you know, not as brash, as crude, but the country's more brash and crude, and Donald is just reflecting that, you see. But he's an echo of Reagan. Reagan crossed over, and Reagan appealed to a lot of the working class and pulled them away from the Democrats. Well, what did Donald do once it was clear? First thing he did when Cruz and Kasich pulled out, where did he go? He went to West Virginia. And he said, we're going to restore the coal industry. He's already won West Virginia. I mean, Hillary will never win West Virginia. That's gone. Not a lot of electoral votes there. You know, Kentucky too, right? That's coal country. Pennsylvania, he's really looking at Pennsylvania when he says that. Now, that's a plum, and some of Ohio even, and Illinois is a coal country. Well, he's already targeting that segment of the working class, which is being devastated, you know, with the collapse of mining in the U.S. Very clever, very Reagan-ish of him. And Hillary better be careful about that. You know, and of course he's against free trade, and most workers in manufacturing and now increasingly in services know what free trade's done to their jobs. You know, he rails against jobs moving to Mexico, and he's pandering to the ignorance and fear of the loss of jobs, not all of which is unrealistic of a big segment of the working class in big states. Manufacturing, mining states, you know, the Midwest. So he's not as dumb as he looks, you know. The left and progressives say, oh, you know, this guy is, you know, the new fascist and so on and so forth, right? And they're railing. Well, that's what they did against Reagan in 1980. You know, the liberals and the progressives and so forth, you know, they said, oh, this guy is so far out, he'll never be elected. Look at the crazy positions he's taking, you know. Well, these people aren't looking at the real discontent, you know, the material discontent, jobs and incomes and wages that is just bubbling down there below the surface in the American society and the economy. It's very significant, very real, and cannot be discounted. Well, you know, Bernie Sanders is also tapping into that, isn't he? He's tapping in with the millennials. You know, 85%, as we said before, previous shows, votes in these primaries among the millennials is going to Bernie. Significant, you know, but what will Bernie do? Well, there's a growing pressure for him to run independently. I don't think he'll do that. I think his plan B is to say, okay, we're going to go back in and reform the Democratic Party, a la George McGovern, 1972. But the Democratic elite will never let another McGovern do that. They'll never allow another McGovern, and as I've written, they will never allow another progressive independent to run on Democratic primaries. You know, they made a big mistake there, and they got burned. And they'll never allow that to happen again. Just as they will never allow him to become their candidate. It's a way of keeping the millennials attached, you know, to the Democratic Party, even at arm's length. There's still a, you know, they haven't broken, they haven't totally left it yet. So Sanders is plugging into the same discontent that Trump is. And don't underestimate Trump, warning to you mainstream Democrats and liberals, because you could get surprised here. Yeah, he's crazy in some things he says, but then if he doesn't really mean what he says, like politicians don't, and I don't trust, you know, half of what he said, or more than half, that he really means. He's pandering. He's saying what people want to hear. But those people, if they hear what they want to hear, will vote for what they want to hear. You see, that's the reality of it. So, okay. That's enough. We'll be writing more about this in future here on my blog, jackrasmus.com, in my articles for Telesur Media out of Caracas, English edition. And some of this we'll post on the PRN website, too, some of these articles, because we're really at a very important juncture here in this election, which is unlike any we've had before in a long time, truthfully. But not unlike some other elections. You know, there are echoes of the past here. Well, let's just look very briefly at what time's left on what's happening globally. I said at the beginning of the show, important developments going on in Europe with the ECB Central Bank Chairman Mario Draghi might be criticized here severely by some of the more conservative banking forces in Europe, particularly by the Germans, you know, and Wolfgang Schäuble and so forth, which is a reflection of the fact that his move into more QE and negative interest rates is not producing results, and so people, you know, among the elite are beginning to criticize him a little bit. And, well, he's shooting back, right? He's shooting back now. So we got splits going on in the economic ruling elite in Europe over policies that aren't working. Right. And what's going to happen here, and, you know, the looming British exit here, and this problem with the refugees that could get worse at any time, and now the Greek debt crisis beginning to reemerge this summer, you know, all this does not portend very well. And if the U.S. does not raise interest rates, then to get a additional boost from their export and share of global trade, they're going to have to do QE or NERP, negative interest rates, even further. But it's not working. So it's a crisis of confidence going on over there in Europe. An even greater crisis of confidence going on for the same reasons over in Japan. Now part of the elite is beginning to break ranks and publicly say that Abenomics, which is the same thing, negative interest rates, QE, massive QE, boost the stock market, drop the currency down, hope to get a little bit more share of global trade to boost home production, manufacturing, to get the economy going, stop deflation, et cetera, et cetera. Not working over there either. It's failing. Right? Main opposition party spokesman, right, that warned that Abenomics is failing, you know, publicly to say that in Japan is significant, right? That means the attack on Shinzo Abe, the prime minister, is going to intensify. But what can the bank, central bank, do? It's, again, it's reliance totally on central bank policy. It's not working. Not working in Japan, not working in Europe. And you go a little further, you know, you've got Korea and South Korea in a funk, economic funk. You know, in Europe, you've got the UK now clearly slowing down as it approaches Brexit, exiting the EU, which is making things even more complicated. The U.S. trying to get a free trade agreement with Europe with all this Brexit going on, and now that's all up in the air. Right? Well, they said the European stimulus is taking hold. What? 0.5% growth? That's a recovery? I don't think so. And meanwhile, China continues to battle with its shadow banks, having problems with shadow banking over there. They can't get their hands around those speculators. Well, they've been pumping so much money into the Chinese economy, and so much debt has increased, you know. I mean, like, shadow banking is like a fungus on debt. The more debt and the more leverage you've got, the more the fungus grows. And fungus is hard to get rid of. And China's policymakers are alternatively trying to boost the economy with stimulus and financial and liquidity injections by central banks and banks, you know, to get the economy growing at more than official 6.7, which is really, as I said last week, somewhere around 4-4.5% by independent estimates. China's not growing that fast, right? And you got a lot of off-balance sheet lending and debt, huge, $25 trillion of debt, a lot of it corporate debt, most of it corporate debt, private debt in China since 2010. Massive. Can China manage that debt? I don't know. Not in the long run, I don't think. I think they're going to have financial problems over there with banks, and they have a lot of money they can throw at it, you know, periodically to try to keep it under control. You know, something that's unique to China. But this shadow banking and this lending and this excess debt, corporate debt and so forth, and speculation going down, cracking down on bubbles, you know, first take a whack-a-mole of bubbles going on. Big problems in China. We'll be talking about it soon. By the way, my book, Systemic Fragility, is being translated in Chinese. So if you want to read it, go to my blog, jackrasmus.com, where you can get a discount. This is Alternative Visions.